All right, we are back with Freedom Rings. I'm Kenneth John. I'd like to welcome to the program this morning Peter Moskus. How are you doing, Peter?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing fine. You are the head of law enforcement against prohibition?
I am not the head.
Okay.
I'm just
spokesman?
One of the 3,600 members of the organization.
Oh, okay. Okay. Very good. And you used to be a police officer.
Yes, I was a police officer in Baltimore, which some people may know from the HBO series The Wire. A lot of that was filmed where I worked.
Okay. Okay. And so you saw firsthand the implementation of drug war policy.
Yes, I was. I was working midnights in the ghetto of East Baltimore.
So Brown.
It's a neighborhood that's been ravaged by drugs and the war on drugs.
And what did you find there? Were you able to be successful at all in this effort?
No. I mean, police normally judge success on number of arrests, and by that standard, we were certainly successful in that police district. We locked up 27,000 people every year, and there's only a population of 45,000 people there. So, I mean, it's an incredible scale of arrests, but it doesn't accomplish anything. The murder rate wasn't going down. The drug trade wasn't going down. I mean, clearly the war on drugs is not being won.
So you continued as a police officer until, what, around 1994? Before that?
No, I was a police officer till 2001.
Oh, and meanwhile, you're going to college.
Yes, I was a grad student at Harvard in sociology the whole time.
I see.
And wrote my PhD dissertation on my experiences there in Baltimore.
And your dissertation was, on the war on drugs. And so what did you conclude in your dissertation?
Well, simply that the war on drugs is and always has been a failure. And until we accept that and then try something different, nothing's going to change. But part of the problem is that the true impact of the war on drugs happens. I mean, it happens a little bit everywhere, but most of it happens in neighborhoods that, quite frankly, people just don't care about, like East Baltimore.
Right, right. What happens with the war on drugs? You create this illicit black market.
That's exactly it. I mean, it's the only drug that we have successfully sort of fought is nicotine. No one kills each other over cigarettes. The government's able to tax cigarettes. Usage rates have gone way down. That, if anything, should be our role model, something that we can legalize, regulate, and tax. You can't regulate an illegal product, and that's one of the main problems with drug prohibition.
Absolutely, and it seems to me. I mean, as an adult, I think I'd have a hard time finding illegal drugs. But the schools are filled with illegal drugs.
I don't know who your friends are, but I can't imagine it'd be that hard for you to find illegal drugs.
Not that I'm looking for them, but I guess my point is that I think the illicit black market seems to concentrate more towards the young people, as far as I can tell. From what I've heard through the grapevine, if you want to just find some marijuana, you know, go to your local teenage kid. It'd probably be a lot easier than your average adult. But
I'm a professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City now, and I ask my students how many of them, well, of course, I don't expect an honest answer when I ask how many of them take drugs, but the real question I ask is how many of them do not take drugs simply because it's illegal? And none of them. And
none of them.
People have reasons not to take drugs, but the law, for better or for worse, is not one of them. And it makes the drug prohibition all the more absurd.
Did you see any corruption going on within the police department vis-a-vis the war on drugs?
Well, no. I'm happy to report I didn't.
Wow.
I was worried about that going in there, going into sort of what had a reputation as the dangerous police district and then working in the midnight shift. I was happy to see that there is no culture of corruption. Or brutality, for that matter, despite what many people think.
Well, you look at the TV shows and the movies, and you think that it's just rampant within the police force.
And it's not. I believe the average police officer has higher integrity than the average college student or professor, for that matter.
I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear that, because I sometimes wonder.
Yeah, well, that being said, I mean...
Or maybe that's a Baltimore thing.
I'm totally naive to say that you know, there's no police corruption. And whenever there is police corruption, it always starts in the narcotics division. It is an inherently dirty business. I mean, look at any large-scale corruption. One of the biggest in the past few years was the Rampart scandal in Los Angeles. It's always in corruption because, as a police officer, you come across large amounts of drugs and money.
Right.
And you're fighting a war on drugs. You can get no... See, most crimes, you need a victim to testify in court. That's what our judicial system is based on. With the war on drugs, however, nine times out of ten is the police officer that is the witness. And, you know, and the state is technically the victim. Because of that, and because of the sort of dismal state of our courts, which are in large part a game, cops don't know how to play that game. And then truth is one of the first casualties. So for the average, because I didn't work in the narcotic squad either, so I saw no,
okay.
no
okay.
culture of corruption, but every scandal comes out of narcotics.
Absolutely. So what do you propose that we do about the drug problem?
I think we need to legalize everything, and I'm not talking about just medicinal marijuana, though, I mean...
So you think a 12-year-old child should be able to go into a drugstore and just buy some heroin?
Well, of course not. No more than a 12-year-old child can go into a drugstore and buy cigarettes or alcohol today. But there are 12-year-olds buying heroin now, and there are 12-year-olds selling heroin now. And it's just too big of a problem to keep in the hands of criminals.
Well, if it's legalized, then it can be regulated, at least.
Exactly. And I think what you would find, in fact, is probably usage rates, if anything, would go down. Some of the cachet would be taken out of drug use. But the most important thing to me isn't that. That, I do think, is a matter for the individual. And, you know, there's no good there's really no treatment for heroin addiction if you get that. I mean, it's an ugly drug. But it would stop the violence around the drug trade. And that, in and of itself, would save thousands of lives.
What do you say to the cultural conservatives who point to, they say, have you been to Amsterdam? It's just, it's a cesspool.
Well, Amsterdam isn't a cesspool. I've spent a lot of time in Amsterdam. My brother lives in Amsterdam, and I've lived there on and off for periods myself. Compared to most American cities, it's heaven in terms of crime rates, in terms of drug usage rates. But don't forget, and it might not be too popular on your show, Amsterdam is a tax and spend, you know, liberal city and a tax and spend liberal country, and to a large part it works. People pay 50% of their taxes, but they get basically safe streets, health care, schools, and sort of all the amenities of civilized society. Their country isn't perfect by any stretch of the means, nor is their drug policy. But in large part, things work a lot better, and specifically with the drug policy that does not... They're not locking up 2 million people a year, the country isn't. They're not having 50% of their convictions based on drug crimes. It's seen as a health problem, and they fight it as such.
Don't we have more people in prison per capita than any other country in the world?
Well, I can't speak for every country, but every country that we like to compare ourselves with, we're really off the scale.
To me, it's an American tragedy, and what a waste of humanity to just to lock them up in prison just because they may have been smoking a marijuana cigarette. And I understand. I know you agree that everything should be legal, and I agree with you on that. But the focus seems to have been lately on just like marijuana possession.
I'm afraid that the various groups that sort of fight the for lack of a better word, the pro drug fight. Even though we're not pro drugs, we're
right.
against the war on drugs. But
right.
I think medicinal marijuana is a bit of a distraction. The fact that it's such an obvious point, and yet still cannot politically, is not happening. In most of the country, at least, but I am talking about legalizing crack and legalizing heroin. And the problem is, when you just talk about marijuana, you focus on whether the drug is good or bad. And with marijuana, you can debate that all you want. Nobody I know says that crack or heroin are good drugs.
Right.
But that's why those are the important ones to legalize.
Well, how do you propose the society go about legalizing? What would we do? What would be the structure of such a legalization?
You know, I'm open to suggestions. I don't have the complete answer. But anything would be better than the status quo, first of all. I would like to see some regulated system, as states regulate liquor and/or cigarettes. You'd have to sell it from a vendor. Whether the people of the state would want it controlled by the state, as you know, some states control the liquor stores or run the liquor stores, and others just regulate them. I think that can be decided, by individual state level. But The important thing is simply that you've got to get the drugs out of the hands of the people with the guns and the violent culture around it.
Well, we had a lot of that in the 19th, roaring 20s, didn't we, with alcohol prohibition?
You think we're going to learn something about that? There are more than just parallels. There are plenty. Alcohol usage rates end up going up during prohibition. After it probably dropped initially when alcohol was first banned, but by the end of prohibition, people were drinking more than at the beginning of prohibition, and the murder rate skyrocketed. The prisons filled. The rights of individual citizens were restricted. Police were accused of, if you can imagine this in today's age, they were accused of conducting searches without warrants and the search for that drug of alcohol.
There was a little tip of the hat to the Constitution back then?
That's where it started. That was the First Amendment that limited the rights of citizens as opposed to limiting government, which was a pretty big shift in the use of the Constitution. But also what's interesting is that when alcohol was legalized, again, at least prohibition was repealed, the prohibition agents didn't give up the fight. The first drug czar, in effect, that wasn't called that back then, was a prohibition agent. They just switched their fight from alcohol to drugs. So that zeal for prohibition, the zeal that sort of fuels the war on drugs, that's the same prohibition movement that's been around for 100 years. There's nothing new about that, and they've never succeeded, but unfortunately they seem to think there's some value in just in prohibition for its own sake. It's not the effectiveness of the policy they're concerned about.
It seems that whatever program is initiated by government, there is always a cadre of individuals or corporations or a group of interest groups that gravitate to that and that feed on it and then live and by necessity have to have that connection. I mean, I think of the military-industrial complex with war. And it's surrounded, as you're saying, with the war on drugs, too. And
don't forget the prison industrial complex now. You have a
right.
Weird confluence of.
Absolutely. You got all these rural communities or whatever that are hurting for jobs, and, you know, they really want to get those prisons by their town so they can.
In large part, it's rural white communities,
right.
And they're locking up, you know. Urban blacks.
Mostly urban blacks. Isn't that true? Absolutely.
Let me remind your listeners, too, that to give a little plug for my organization, LEAP, a lot more information can be found at our website, which is LEAP, L-E-A-P. It stands for Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. LEAP.cc is the website. And we welcome everyone to join. Even non-law enforcement can join as a friend of LEAP. And it's free, and we don't spam at all, and we don't share a membership list.
Great.
I urge everyone to. We also have speakers available that can come out to your organization and give a presentation for drug legalization. And there's a phone number to be called in Boston, and that is 781-393-6985.
Why don't you give that one more time?
781-393-6985.
Okay, very good.
The website is leap.cc.
I don't know if you could answer this or not, but if you had to guess, what percentage of law enforcement that you know of would be, let's say first just inclined to change the direction of the drug war and what percentage ultimately would actually be in favor of total legalization?
I am sad to report that most law enforcement does not support legalization at all. I gave out surveys when I was a police officer in Baltimore, and I was just asking about liberalizing marijuana laws, and even that the majority of police officers are against it. Police officers they've been sold the war on drugs for too long, I think. That being said, there are more law enforcement officials, there is a significant minority of law enforcement officials who have sort of looked at the issue and wised up a bit. And that's what our organization, LEAP, is about. It's all former police officers, prosecutors, judges, and a few current ones who are very brave, who realize the failure of the war on drugs. But I think, like society, it does require a little education. So that's why it's good to have shows like yours.
Well, why do you think you've come to different conclusions than your fellow colleagues on the police force? What is it that got you? That's a difficult question. Maybe I'm just wondering how we could maybe learn to educate the police. I mean, if we could get the police in some good numbers to recognize what's going on, maybe we'd make a great inroad in changing the direction of drug policy.
There are a couple ways. I mean, part of my realization did start in Amsterdam. I lived there and did research on the police in Amsterdam before I was a police officer in Baltimore. And so I did know there was another way. Police officers, well, in general, they're not the most intellectual group. They don't travel that much. You know, just sort of expanding your horizons a bit and seeing an alternative, because they're just unaware of Amsterdam, except with an image of a cesspool of drugs and prostitution. But there are also more concrete things you could do in this country. You could realize that the damage from drugs, when people talk about drug-related homicides, it's not that users are smoking up and shooting each other. Now, that hardly ever happens. 80 to 90% of drug-related homicides are related to the drug trade.
Right.
Because drug dealers either fighting for turf, they're not nice people, don't get me wrong.
What other way there is there to adjudicate their disputes? They can't go to the courts.
That's exactly it. So I think when you present these basic arguments to law enforcement and others, then you quickly see sort of a light go on in their eyes, and they kind of go, "Oh yeah, that does make sense." So it's analyzing the issue a bit. It's accepting the fact that yes, drugs are bad, and yes, we still need to manage the situation better. Prohibition is not the answer.
We're talking with Peter Muskus. He's with the Law Enforcement Against Prohibition Group, which is at leap.cc, if you want to check them out on their website. The phone number here is 847-931-1410. That's 931-1410. If you have any questions, comments, observations, analyses, please give us a call. We will be back after a few messages. All right, we are back with Freedom Rings. I'm Kenneth John. We're talking with Peter Muskus, who is with the Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And we do have Walter. Hello, Walter. You're on the air.
Yeah, Ken. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
All right, good. I just wanted to say to Peter that I really appreciate the work that he's doing. I first got informed about LEAP when we had Sheriff Masters talk to us, and I have a lot of respect for Sheriff Masters, Peter. I don't know. Do you know him?
I don't personally.
Okay.
No, but
he's a sheriff out of Colorado, I believe.
Yeah, Telluride.
Telluride.
And his book actually mentioned that what you were talking about before is that, because it's actually called Drug War Addiction, and that it seems like so much of law enforcement now is actually addicted to the war itself and the money and the power and I guess everything else that goes along with it. That's why I'm wondering. I mean, I think we need something, I don't know, some sort of kickstart, because every time a law enforcement member actually comes out against the war on drugs, that seems to be a great shot in the arm. But on the other, I need something to jumpstart that whole thing to point out, you know, that it's really the money and the power that goes with it that seems to drive law enforcement to continually want to keep up this war.
Well, there isn't. I mean, there are many. The drug forfeiture laws that, especially smaller law enforcement agencies are addicted to. And this is money that is taken from people on the suspicion of being drug money, but it doesn't. You don't have to go through the traditional court process to seize the money. So law enforcement, you know, your budget's based on this continuing influx of drug money, and much of that money is dirty drug money, but not all of it. And that's part of the problem with the war on drugs. Another significant problem is that because police are so focused on drugs, it turns the citizens of drug areas against police. I mean, it's ironic that those neighborhoods where people most need police protection, those neighborhoods that are most ravaged by drug violence, usually are the most anti-police neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And the reason is because police officers are somewhat indiscriminately enforcing or fighting this war on drugs, and it affects a lot of people who aren't involved in drugs.
There's a lot of collateral damage out there, huh?
That's exactly.
Yeah, and I think that's the policy of those who believe in the huge use of force. Don't understand whether it be, again, I'm going to generalize it, whether it be in the drug war or the wars we're perpetrating throughout the globe. For some reason, these people who believe in force, like the neocon types, they just disregard all this so-called. I just lost my term.
Collateral
damage.
Yeah.
And what the collateral damage does is it builds recruits, whether it's recruits into the drug community, or recruits against, you know, Islamic extremist recruits.
And just like, you know, Republican chicken hawks who start foreign wars and don't have any of their sons or daughter actually serving and fighting in these wars.
Yes.
The people who make drug policy in this country, they don't live in East Baltimore. They don't live in neighborhoods that are, you know, in the south and west sides of Chicago.
Good point.
Those are communities that don't have much power and say in government. And so the people making the drug laws don't have to deal with the damage.
Well, that's the point. It's always this white hypocrisy, it seems.
It's easy for, you know, white suburban Republicans to, they're worried that their daughter, you know, they see movies and, like, Traffic, and are worried that their cute daughter is going to go to the ghetto and get addicted to heroin. But that's not the issue. That's fiction.
Yeah,
it happens occasionally. The real damage is a poor drug ravaged communities, and there are plenty in Chicago.
And you're throwing to a great extent black young males in prison. And where is the family base in the future to bring up children properly?
Well, and for those who, and it tends to be more of a conservative critique, but those who blame culture and say there's something, you know, screwed up about ghetto culture, there are elements of truth to that. But that could also be changed by legalizing drugs. Part of what makes the culture screwed up is that it's tough to get by, especially if you're uneducated and poor and black living in on the west side of Chicago. The people who do have, and most drug dealers not getting that rich, but still, that is the most viable economy. That's the most viable.
Well, it beats the heck out of working for McDonald's for $6 an hour or whatever.
Yeah, but the irony is there is a lot of money in drugs, but most of it goes only to the few at the top. The average guy standing on the corner, and there have been some good recent studies looking at this, the average guy standing on the corner swinging isn't even making minimum wage. And there's no paid vacation. There's a very high risk of death. So there's something. There is a bit of the glamour and the bling bling lifestyle that is what is appealing to a lot of inner city youth. And in the abstract, a lot of white suburban youth too. But they're not getting shot over it.
Walter, any other points you'd like to make?
No, just I really appreciate the work that you're doing on this. I guess we just need to get more people kind of a little bit more involved, and I just wanted to say that I appreciate you saying, you know, that we don't need the diversions of medical marijuana and all that you know, we really need to come out strong and say, you know, it's legalization that's going to help solve this problem.
And if marijuana were decriminalized or legalized in this country, I mean, that is the largest groundswell of support against the war on drugs, but once that happened, I mean, every stoner in the nation would be, you know, sitting on their couch eating potato chips.
Right.
These people we need on our side.
Right. Exactly.
And utopian pizza.
Right.
All right. Well, thanks for your call.
You bet.
Appreciate it.
Yeah.
All right. We've got Bob on the line. Hello, Bob.
Hi there. You know, the abortion is an issue that revolves around a woman owning her body, and I think anybody that's pro-abortion has to be realizing that the same applies to drugs. I you know, it seems like when self-ownership is primary in our view, and abortion is an indication of that, I guess, although...
Well, one could argue, you know, we're talking one or two human beings there, but I get your point, Bob.
Yeah, that obviously kills an unborn child, so it would seem it would slant more, you know, towards the drug legalization issue. But there was an article yesterday in the Herald about the methamphetamine proliferation in these Midwestern states, and the county sheriffs are being just deluged with new prisoners who have been, you know, arrested on methamphetamine charges. And one sheriff indicated the last sentence in the article was, you know, we should be putting people in jail that we're afraid of, but not people that we're mad at. And, you know, that very simple statement says a lot, because most of these people we're not really afraid of, we're just mad at them.
Not what our prisons were built for.
No, well, yeah, why we're spending, what is it, I don't know, $55,000 a year or more to incarcerate a person just because they want to self-medicate themselves, I don't get it. I just don't get it. But I think when you say, you know, it's the continuation of this, the progressive moralists or whatever who were in favor of alcohol prohibition, and it's just, some people just like to control other people's lives, I guess. I don't know. It seems like they like to play God.
They believe they know better. It's ironic because history has proven them wrong many times.
Over and over and over again. Bob, any other points?
Actually, I just wanted to mention that the John Birch Society is having a Free Trade Areas of the Americas speech this weekend on Friday at the Lindner Center in Lombard. So I invite people to come to that.
Where's that at?
That's
in Lombard.
That's at 660 East Butterfield Road in Lombard.
Okay, what time?
7:30.
7:30, and this is again on the
Free Trade Areas of the Americas.
Okay.
So I appreciate your time.
All right, thanks a lot, Bob. I appreciate it. Okay, and we have John. Hello, John.
Hello, Ken. Peter, you're saying that street corner drug dealers in poor areas aren't even making a minimum wage. What's their incentive to do it?
Well, the incentive is it's more than nothing. It is part of the answer. Their incentive is a lifestyle. They're around money. They suddenly get laid more. You know, if women admire drug dealers, that's going to encourage guys to deal drugs. There's a matter of peer pressure. Your friends are doing it. There's an element of danger. I mean, certainly a more interesting lifestyle than if you're not dealing drugs. But again, it often ends in death. And also, the difference between a drug dealer and a junkie is usually just a matter of time. Most drug users at some point sell drugs.
So they're funding their habits.
Drug dealers end up using drugs. It's not such a clear-cut distinction between the dealer and the user.
Okay. So I'm getting the impression that you're saying most of the drug money that is being made on the illicit market is leaving the country?
No, I didn't say. I don't. Who knows what happened? At some point, you know, except for marijuana, the drugs, you know, come from other countries. Most of the drug money and drug organizations goes to people higher up. They're not going to be the people on the street. It's more of what are considered the kingpin. It's like the classic mob organization. There are bosses, and they're making a lot of money. And that boss may just control a few corners, may control a dozen street corners. But that person is reaping most of the profits from the street-level drug trade. What he then does with the money, your guess is as good as mine.
Well, yeah. The thing is that during alcohol prohibition, most of the money stayed in this country with organized crime families, whether they be ethnic or otherwise. And we're still living with some of that stuff because they didn't know what to do with the money except to invest in legitimate business.
Well, if anything, that provides a role model. I mean, the Kennedy family every turn drug dealing, whether it was or bootlegging at the time.
Right, and but we're still living with them because
their money off the merchandise.
These families are just heavily into corporate ownership.
John, are you suggesting that a president we're going to have in 20 or 30 years is going to be named Gonzalez or Hernandez or something like that?
That's a possibility. But
Medellin cartel or something.
Well, I mean, if the money is staying in this country, I mean, they have to be investing it or doing something to make more money with it. I mean, you just can't.
Well, the smart
can't
ones
just
wouldn't.
Stack
I'm
up
sure
money
some are,
and evolve someplace.
And they're, you know, businesses to launder money and spawns lots of other illegal activities. A lot of it is just being spent on a lavish lifestyle and consumerism.
And Cadillac coffins.
Yeah.
And you got to get the rims on your feet.
And so you're on another tact, you're saying that this is primarily a states' rights issue and that the federal government should get out of it altogether?
I would like to see in any way that would happen. I don't really care which political side, though I have to say I'm not a big fan of the John Birch Society. But whether it's from a libertarian perspective of individual rights, whether it's from a liberal democratic idea of just making a better society, I mean, the different ways you could do it. The means to the end, to me, are less important than achieving some rationality in our drug policy.
Many ways to skin a cat, so to speak.
Yeah. I don't see it as a political issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it is interesting because just as the war on drugs unites people across the political spectrum, so does drug legalization. I mean, you can, depending on your audience, if you're speaking to conservative Republicans, you can stress individual responsibility. If you're speaking to libertarians, you can say, why is the government in this? And if you're speaking to Democrats, you can just use common sense and rational arguments, but you can win the argument pretty much with all sides of the political spectrum.
Okay, John, thanks for your call.
Okay.
Appreciate it. This is Freedom Rings. I'm Kenneth John. We're talking to Peter Moskowitz with the Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. The phone number here is 847-931-1410. We will be back after a few messages. Okay, we are back with Freedom Rings. We're talking with Peter Moskowitz with LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And let's go right back to the phones. We have, Bob just cut off. Okay, so we don't have Bob on the line. All right, you just missed it, Bob. Peter, I just happened to realize or recognize that, you're from Baltimore. And
I'm actually from Chicago.
Oh, you're originally from Chicago. Okay, but you were a Baltimore.
I was in Chicago when I grew up in Evanston.
Oh, very interesting. But you were a Baltimore police officer, and as I recall, way back when the drug war really, started its heyday back in the late '80s. I think it was the late '80s already. You had a mayor of Baltimore, I believe, Kurt Schmoke. Is that?
Yes, that's
who came out for legalization a long time ago.
He,
or at least a certain semblance of it.
Yeah, he was into harm reduction.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, I believe, at the law school at Harvard. It's a shame because he's a smart man who meant well and had good intellectual ideas and is viewed as a failed mayor by
is that right?
Virtually everybody in Baltimore from all sides. And he, in a sense, in Baltimore at least, he gave a bad name to harm reduction.
Okay.
Maybe as a professor, if he continues in politics in the future, he has some wonderful ideas, but if anything, he was counterproductive in Baltimore because they used him as an example of what not to do.
Okay. All right, we do have Bob back in line, so a quick question by Bob.
Yeah, basically on this war on drugs, anytime there's a demand, you'll find somebody willing to supply it. So the one method that you might be able to do is social acceptability. If you drive home to the people that if they take drugs, they're not worth it, really. They better get their act in under control because they're just a drug. They're just an exorbitant amount of money that we spend on it and put them in jail. That's ridiculous. They don't respect humanity. They don't respect. They can't get along in society. So we give them free room and board and health and everything. So that's ridiculous. But the main focus should be on acceptability, not acceptability. You want to take the drugs? Go ahead and do it. Go in the cornfield and whatever you want to do, but don't come back for us for room and board.
Okay.
It may seem harsh, but that's it.
Thanks for your viewpoint, Bob. Any comments on that, Peter?
People are talking about the free room and board and free hot tin of prison life. Prison is no summer camp, so people don't want to go to prison, even if you don't have to pay money to be there. The problem with education, of course, is part of it, is a big part of the answer, and especially with what I consider the bad drugs of crack and heroin and speed and crystal meth. But you also don't want to get into sort of a reefer madness style approach that was used in the 50s that's now mocked. And reefer madness did a lot to spread the use of marijuana in this nation.
I would think so.
People didn't know what it was until those humorously anti-drug right. movies came out. People take drugs in part because drugs are fun. People, smoke marijuana because they like it. People take ecstasy because it makes them feel good. So
right.
Your education can't just say drugs are bad because when people hear that and then, they try it and go, well, they're lying to me.
Peter, thank you very much for being on the program today. LEAP.cc. You can check it out on the internet.
The website.
All right,
thanks for having me.
Thank you very much.